Say, I called my talk Living in the Mandala, which is the title of the retreat we've got coming up here in 2 or 3 weeks' time, because I wanted us to just tune in with that theme before that retreat. But actually, before I go on to talk about that, I'm just going to talk a bit more about our overall theme of building the Buddha land. Just talk about that a bit more generally. Because I'm wondering a bit, well, how you're finding it, whether it's kind of hanging together, making sense for you. At least one friend has been saying to me, I don't quite get where this is going and it doesn't seem to link up and I don't quite know what it's all about. So I thought there might be other people in that position and it would be good to fill it out a bit more. Maybe actually we haven't really given a talk that explains what it is we're doing with this theme and sort of sums it up. We've had various different talks. So the Buddha land or the Buddha field, different words for the same thing. The Buddha land is a sphere of influence of a Buddha. So this field of adhisthana, of blessings, of grace that Bhadra was talking about recently. All of where that extends to, that whole sort of sphere, that whole realm of a Buddha. And it's what's created by a Buddha or a Bodhisattva naturally. There's a sort of patterning that goes on in that. It's made of living beings. A Bodhisattva can't create a Buddha land in the abstract. It's not sort of, you know, just a sort of grace waves landing in space alone. It's got to have kind of material to work on. And so we need people. We need people to engage with the Buddha land. So a Buddha, a Bodhisattva or a Buddha can't create a Buddha land on their own. They need living beings to create a Buddha land with or out of. Need people to influence. A Bodhisattva needs people to influence, create. And they need to be people who want to be in a Buddha land. In Bhante's talk on this theme, he says, you can't hold people there indefinitely or against their will. They've got to want to be there. Actually, most of us would get bored and not really want to stay there. It's kind of going to be, Taranita talked about this in his talk a few weeks ago. So they've got to want to be there. They've got to want to create a Buddha land themselves, for themselves and for others. They've got to want to open to the Buddha and the Dharma and see that expressed through each other, through themselves, and work together to really share that influence of the Dharma, that influence of the Buddha, and spread its influence further, sort of help it along. So in fact, a Buddha land is really made up of, you could say, aspiring bodhisattvas, people who are opening to the Dharma, opening towards enlightenment for the sake of others, people who are working on their responses to themselves and to others for the benefit of all. People who at least sometimes can act on the basis of something beyond their self-interest and see that doing that is the kindest thing for themselves as well. A quote from Sangharakshita on that. One cannot really help oneself without helping others. One cannot really help others without helping oneself. Man is a social being. Man cannot really cut himself off from other people, not for any length of time, though he may, of course, cut himself off from physical contact with them. He influences them. They influence him. What he does to himself has its effect on them. What he does to them or for them has its effect on him. If he develops emotional positivity, imagination, insight within himself, it affects them too. If he works for them, gives to them, sacrifices for them, it affects him too. So the other thing about the Buddha land is that it exists for each of us to the extent we practice effectively. And Taranita talked about this sort of pure land and how that was really partly about what we perceive. So to the extent that we purify our minds and hearts and our perceptions, we see a pure land. So it's up to each of us to be doing that. I think one reason it's a bit hard to kind of get the sense of this theme, perhaps, is that it is a myth. The Buddha land, building the Buddha land, is a myth or a symbol of Sangha in action. And the whole point about myth, this is Sangharakshita again, is that it is a realm of not clearly defined meanings, but of undefined, even indefinable meanings. It's the same realm to which belong such things as symbols, archetypal images, the imagination itself, and poetry. So it's not something you kind of quite get in that kind of trying to understand literal, linear, rational kind of way. It's an image, a symbol to open up to with your imagination. And another reason is that it is about Sangha, which has this kind of, I've been saying, this series of talks is more like a mosaic than a sort of linear progression. So Sangha's like that too, isn't it? We've had different speakers coming in and sharing their take, their inspiration on the Buddha land. And the Sangha's like that. It's made up of individual jewels. So it's hard to kind of really encapsulate quite what it is. And Sangha, building the Buddha land, it has to be done. It has to be experienced. It's not really a thing to understand. It's like that with any of the Dharma, really. You can read about it and understand the theory, but really it's something to be practiced, something to become, something to be, something to do, rather than to just understand rationally or as a sort of dogma. That'll, you know, might kind of open up something, but on the whole, it's about your practice. Again, it's like you create the Buddha land, you see the Buddha land if you practice. That's what does it. So yeah, we've got this mosaic of talks. They're not linear, but hopefully they are suggesting this indefinable something. Something more like an atmosphere that we create between us than a thing to understand. And that can be very lovely. And I think, you know, we have experienced that on these evenings. I certainly have myself in some of the small groups. Sometimes people have just all been sharing something inspiring. And it's really, you know, I've kind of been able to respond to each of those. I've felt that inspiration. And it's like, even if I've gone in feeling a bit, then it can be really uplifting. And that is building the Buddha land. That's exactly it, that influencing each other in positive ways. And the effect of that is immeasurable. It's, you know, we don't know where that ends, really. Like the parasols that have been referred to. We've had a couple of talks talking about these parasols where all these beautiful youths bring together these beautiful parasols and somehow they merge into this cosmic, bejeweled, amazing thing. Well, you know, something more happens between us than what each of us is bringing. Something that could be as vast as that vast parasol, with effects much further than we might normally consider. And that might happen in quite ordinary ways, that sort of ripple effect of, well, if you have an uplifting evening, you go home and you're a bit nicer to whoever's at home or whoever you see tomorrow, and then they're nicer to someone else, and, you know, that kind of kindness and goodwill spreads out like that, and you don't really know where that ends. It can be in the atmosphere we create between us, that sort of special something that I think most of us feel when we just step into this room. There's this atmosphere of Sangha, of meditation that we have created here. And I believe it does have an effect further out beyond us, that somehow we are creating a kind of energetic field that will have effects, you know, on Bishopston, if you like, and who knows how far. And it's not easy. Building a Buddha land really isn't easy. It's sort of a very lovely ideal, but actually a lot of the time it's more like the building site than the pure land. It's a thing we're doing. It's the emphasis is on the building rather than the pure land. It's the thing we're doing together. And it's not easy. We've all got our own particular responses to being with other people, and that might be quite a lot of difficulties, quite a lot of resistances for some of us. So it doesn't always look like a Buddha land, because what we're actually aware of is what's uncomfortable or difficult. So I've been finding this quite a lot lately. I've been really trying to kind of step up my commitment to this Sangha and be here more and, you know, just show up and be here and be available to people more, doing more things. I'm trying to steer a vision that I want to bring into being for what this Sangha could be. And that is the only thing that makes any sense to me as what to do with my life. It's the only thing that's meaningful. And it's really, really uncomfortable. Because I think it just brings up the deeply held beliefs I have about myself. And I think all of us have our versions of these that kind of come up around other people. So for me, I've been in touch a lot lately with something along the lines of a belief that if I really share my heart, people just won't get it. And they'll either reject me because I've said something, you know, shared something really kind of silly or that they don't like. Or in order to keep in connection with these people, I'll have to just give in and go with their way of seeing things and throw out what's actually really precious and meaningful to me somehow, that it'll somehow be, you know, spoilt. And then there's like, you know, we've been talking in our team meeting this afternoon about like how much need, how much suffering there is in the world and how hard it is to keep open to that when you can't actually meet it, you can't respond, and how you manage in that tension. And that's, you know, like someone was saying, and it's the same for me, that taps into a sort of like, oh, whatever I do is never good enough. And then if I have a difficult communication with someone, that taps into, oh, whatever I do, it's never going to be good enough. I'm never good enough, however hard I try. And we've all got beliefs about ourselves like this. We've all got views, which might seem a bit daft if you say them out loud. They're usually not even very conscious, but they shape the way we experience the world. They define what we choose to notice and what happens, because whether or not it sort of supports our belief and our story. Our interpretations are based on it. And I see this going on with myself and people around me all the time. I just see people encountering, I can't do this. I'm not good enough. I don't count. I don't make any difference. I don't matter. I don't fit in. I'm on my own. I'm alone in this. I'm right. To stay true to what's right means being alone. Just all sorts of variations of things like this. So I think these things come up when we're with other people. They come up in the communications where we don't see eye to eye quite often, where we, you know, things aren't smooth. And, you know, it can be excruciating at times. It can be a real rock and a hard place. It's like, you know, I don't want to be isolated and alone, but actually being with other people can bring up all sorts of uncomfortable things as well. So, you know, like, what do you do? I think the only thing to do is to hang on in there and stay in communication, as some of my friends have coined this phrase lately. Just stay in there, keep communicating. Because the Buddha land exists only in the act of building, in this act of building, working on the building site, which is about communication and relating to each other. And it's a wonderful opportunity, because usually these beliefs we hold aren't very conscious, they're under the surface. But once you kind of find yourself in a difficulty and go, what's that about? And you can start to unearth some of these beliefs, these views. You've got an opportunity to test out whether that's really true, whether it's something you want to be shaped by. You start to see how it operates in your life and it starts to loosen its hold. You can just start to open it up a bit, see through it, which it gives us the opportunity to really open into the bigness we can be, into boundless love, I think, every time you can kind of release some of this sort of constriction we live in. So, yes, that's building the Buddha land, generally. So, living in the mandala. Living in the mandala as an offering to the world. So, as I've said, the Buddha land is the sphere of influence, the sphere of adhisthana of a Buddha, and we are all in that. Whether we open to it or not, we're all in touch with the influence of the Buddha, or we wouldn't be here. We've all heard something of the Buddha, we all know something of the Buddha. We're in the realm of the Buddha Shakyamuni, and the patterning influence of that. And another way of describing that is the mandala. So the mandala is also the pattern that forms around enlightenment, around an enlightened, a Buddha or a Bodhisattva or an image of enlightenment. So our retreat in 2 or 3 weeks is one of the big events of our year. It's a rainy season retreat. We stop all our regular activities and have a retreat here at the Buddhist Centre. And that's for those who are most committed to practicing within Tri Ratna. So it's just for order members and for mitras. People have had ritual expressions of being a Buddhist and this being the commitment, this being the context that they're practicing as Buddhists within. So it's going to be led by a very experienced order member called Ratnavandana and me and Karuna Varpi. So we're going to be here with some others from 7 in the morning till 9 at night every day for a week on retreat, just like you would at a retreat centre, except we have to go home to bed. So we're really enthusiastic about practicing together in this way, and we just really hope other order members and mitras will come and join us and really take that on as fully as they're able as well. So, yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about the theme, partly as a trailer for order members and mitras, but particularly also for everybody here, because we're not doing this just for ourselves, we're doing it for all of us, because, we really believe the best thing we can do is to really deepen our practice so we've got more to share. And I really do think that that energy then spreads out and has an effect on everybody in the Sangha, and who knows how far out into the world. And that will happen best if you're a little bit in tune with what we're doing. I mean, it's not essential, I don't think, but I think it will just help if you've got a little bit of a flavour of what we're doing on that retreat. So, yeah, just being aware of what's going on here will have an effect whether or not you're actually here. So, yeah, the retreat is called Living in the Mandala. And it refers to the mandala of the 5 Buddhas and the mandala of the Brahma Viharas, these different expressions of metta, which I'll go and say a bit about later if I don't run out of time. So, yeah, as I said, a mandala is a pattern with enlightenment at the centre. And it's got walls. I really like the walls. There's a wall of lotuses of purity, one layer, and there's a wall of vajras of determination and a wall of flames of transformation around these. I like these because my name, Jwalamalini, means garlanded with flames, and it was given to me, and what Ratnadharani said when she gave me my name was that it was to remind me that all of my life, which at the time involved running a house and a family and a business and being a dentist and all sorts of other things, which I always struggled to sort of see as part of my spiritual life. She said, all of that is enclosed. It's all part of the mandala. It's all enclosed in this ring of flames. So all of that is my arena of practice. And my name was to remind me of that. So there's a sense of these walls as containing, protecting, holding. And they're vast. The mandala is endless. It holds everything. It holds the whole universe. It holds all of samsara and nirvana, all of our tendencies to close around our sense of self, all of our tendencies to open beyond that, everything. Just as awareness can be really unlimited and open, just as this parasol made of all our parasols is really cosmic, the mandala is like that. It contains the whole universe. It's got no limits, and yet these walls are its edges. So there's a kind of paradox in that in itself. So again, it's a symbol. It's a myth. It's something, it's not something that you understand in a rational way. But something happens when you live informed by a myth of awakening. When you let your life be patterned by the Buddha's influence, by transcendent awareness and love. It's like that sets up this really dynamic, interesting patterning all the time. It's like always moving. It's a bit like, don't know, a kaleidoscope or something. There's all the different conditions we each bring, our own karma and all the things that happen and the ways we all interact. And the influence of the Buddha or Bodhisattva kind of shapes all that in particular ways. And I think the more you can open to that, tune into that, you start to be able to choose internal and external conditions that work with that patterning and flow with it. The more you can understand yourself and how things work on you, how conditions act on you, you can kind of let that patterning happen more. So I feel since I was ordained and given this amazing name to remind me my whole complicated life was in the mandala, my external conditions have changed totally. 5 years ago, I was still a dentist and living with my family, and now I live on my own, work at the Buddhist Centre, and loads of things have changed externally. And my cooperation with that happening has varied. I haven't always wanted those changes wholeheartedly. Some of it's been painful. But when I've been able to really yield to the change as it happens, it's like it's freed me. It's freed me to give more energy to the Dharma, and it's changed who I am in myself. But I think the really important thing is the internal patterning, letting that happen too. So again, it all depends on our practice, on our perceptions. And it's within our hearts and minds that we really get the real nitty-gritty, the real place of practice, whatever our external situation is. So on the rainy season retreat, we'll be exploring the nitty-gritty of our responses to ourselves and others through the lens, through the practice of the Brahma Viharas. So these Brahma Viharas means the abodes of the gods, and they're states, realms, practices that are exploring the ways that metta manifests in different circumstances. So the first one is metta, that we're all familiar with from the Metta Bhavana, and that manifests in different ways, in different circumstances. So metta is the baseline, which you can think of as our willingness to engage, to really engage with our experience, be with it, and be with others with that. Our willingness to empathise with others and ourselves. So it's really about awareness, empathy, love, engagement, connection. Then when metta meets painful experience, there's karuna, compassion, as the kind of metaphor response to compassion. That's not always what happens, which I might just say a little bit about. But actually, again, in the Metta Bhavana, we practice like this all the time. When we meet painful experience, when we bring to mind someone we don't like, basically what someone we don't like is someone that we find painful to bring to mind in some way, unpleasant to bring to mind. So actually, what we can do with that is all sorts of self-hatred and how bad I am to think that bad thing. But actually, in the Metta Bhavana, we're working to just open and be compassionate, first of all, I think, to ourselves, and then start to understand this other person. When metta meets pleasant experience, there's what's called mudita, which is joy, sympathetic joy is the translation. We haven't really got a word for that in English. We've got compassion to translate karuna, but mudita is this delighting in someone else's delight or delighting in our own delight, a sort of spiralling of that. And then when those are both in the picture, and we really understand that that is part of the picture for every human being, we understand how we create our own joy and our own pain. And when we've developed some capacity to actually respond to that, as well as the willingness of metta, then that starts to move into equanimity, upekkha. So it's, again, a very, very deeply loving state that's really able to hold the fullness of human experience. So, again, awareness, but with balance and clarity, with insight, really. A sort of real letting go, big perspective. So, actually, all these are about opening beyond our usual perspective, where we're usually tightening around a limited, separate selfhood. So they're also called the immeasurables, because they're ultimately about a boundless state of loving being. They're not limited by time or space. Their effects can really spread like light, wherever your awareness can reach to, these immeasurable states can reach to. And they're most easily seen by what they're not. So they've each got what we call near and far enemies, which are what happens when our response has got more of ourself in there, when it's more about me, actually, than the other person, perhaps. So they're states of more identification and clinging. So the far enemies are the opposite of the metaphor responses, the immeasurable responses, which is where our meing activity, our selfing, is gross and extreme. So the far enemy of metta is hatred, ill will, aversion, turning away from experience. They've all got a kind of opposite extreme like that. I know where there's pain and suffering, I can often feel angry and irritated, you know, say you have to moan for rather than being compassionate. There's a sort of more of a ill will response, which is really about me not wanting to experience pain. It's not about that other person at all. It's me not quite being able to take on what's going on. The far enemy of mudita, of delight in others' happiness, is envy and resentment, which again I'm very familiar with. And opposite to equanimity, there's a sort of cold, active indifference, a real sort of, again, not wanting to know. The near enemies are more subtle. So they're more like impersonators of the pure state, if you like, of the true immeasurable. And again, they've all got a sort of self-interest in. So the near enemy of metta is a sort of self-interested affection. A sort of friendship where you're really in it for what you're getting out of it. Karuna, there's different ones. There's a sort of subtle avoidance that comes up in pity. So pity can look like compassion, but it can be a sort of like, oh dear, poor you, that's not really feeling with, not really getting what it's like for the other person. So there's sort of not really enough feeling in it. It's a slightly removed state. Or there's horrified anxiety where it's just all too much and you're completely overwhelmed by really kind of getting in there in the painful state with somebody. And they go on like this. With mudita, there's a sort of, again, slightly distant. It sort of looks all right, but you're not actually feeling it. You're sort of going, oh, yes, that's very nice for her. I'm really pleased. But you're not really, really feeling it. And with equanimity, again, there's a lack of feeling, passive indifference. So those can be subtle. Yeah, they can look like the right thing. You can be easily taken in, but they don't have this opening, expansive, immeasurable, limitless quality. So that's just a very quick sort of summary of what we're going to be exploring in the rainy season. And I'm just really pleased we're going to be led by Ratna Vandana, because she practices with this in her daily life all the time in relation to the five Buddhas, these five different coloured archetypes of enlightenment, which highlight different aspects of the transcendental awakened awareness of immeasurable love. And she likes to try and think of each moment of her life, each thing she does, as an offering to the Buddhas and the world. So we'll be sitting with images of the Buddhas, we'll be meditating, we'll be doing specific bhavana practices for these different Brahma Viharas, hearing talks, all the things you do on retreat, doing pujas open to the influence of the Buddhas. But we're doing that as an offering, in the way that Ratna Vandana likes to live, as an offering to the world. All of us participating in that practice are doing it as an offering to all of us here, to the whole of the Bristol Sangha, and to the world. I'm sure we'll be transferring our merits. So if you're not here, just bear us in mind and, you know, catch some merit. It's like, it's no point us doing that if you don't get it. So just, you know, take the time to open to it occasionally. Just try and remember, oh yeah, that's what's going on. And just think what that's like. You might just think of us daily. You might decide to do the Metta Bhavana daily yourself at home for that week, just to keep in tune. And you could do that in a way that's about opening to receiving kindness, because you can know that we'll be beaming it towards you from the shrine room here. You might want to read up about the themes of the retreat. I recommend Kamala Shila's Haynes Manual of Meditation, Buddhist Meditation. There's a little bit in there about the Brahmaviharas, or half a chapter that really goes into it, spells it out very clearly. Or Vasantra's book on the Guide to the Buddhas, to tune in about the different Buddhas we'll be sitting with. And hopefully we'll be posting some of the teachings on the website as we go through the week, so you could look those up and tune in that way too. But yeah, just bear us in mind, really. I think it'll have a big effect on the people here and all of us. And yeah, you might just notice what it brings up for you, that that's happening, really, how that seems for you, whether you feel moved, inspired, excluded, you know, whatever it might be. Or how determined you are to get here, if you're able to, how much effort you're willing to make to participate, how determined you are to really make the most of practicing that week anyway, whatever you're doing in your life. Whatever it is, it's all useful information, useful practice compost. And yeah, just keep clocking. Where are you in relation to the Brahmaviharas each day? Are you opening? Are you tight? Where is the metta in your life? How could your life be more of an offering to the world? So our questions for our groups are, do you believe that what we do here makes a difference to the world? Do you believe it has an influence? How do you benefit from being with the Sangha? And in what ways is that difficult for you? Is it sometimes difficult to participate? Why?